From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made March 8th when a 14-year-old boy with special needs walked off his school bus and never returned to school or to his home. Trevion Rowe was a student at school number 12, and since his disappearance on that day and when his body was found in the Genesee River 4 days later, we've heard community conversations about how a series of system failures, adult failures, led to his death. This hour, we're having a discussion about what we know at this time, who is accountable, and what needs to change in order to prevent something like this from ever happening again. A young student lost his life. Our condolences go out to his family and friends. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. I would like to acknowledge right off the top, this is a very difficult conversation to have, and I truly appreciate them being here. T. Andrew Brown is Vice Chancellor for the Board of Regents. Thank you for coming on the program. Melody Funches is the Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. She is also a commissioner for the Rochester City School Board. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Terry Mine is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives for Happiness House and CP Rochester. Thank you for being here, Terry.
Thank you for
having us. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did.
Good. Remind our listeners about the mission of your two organizations, Terry.
So the two organizations are human service organizations that provide service for individuals with and without disabilities from birth to end of life. And our goal is for people to live the life that they choose and to reach their individual goals.
I know that some listeners have some concerns about the city school district and whether or not they are being represented on this panel. I'll say right off the top, we did reach out to them numerous times. They did provide someone to be on this panel last week when we had it set up, but due to the death of Louise Slaughter, we had to reschedule this conversation. And since that time, since Friday, we have not heard from them either by phone or email. But that invitation remains open to them. They are always welcome to participate in discussions on this program, so we hope to hear from them in the future. I'd like to start the hour by just going through a timeline of the events that happened with Trevion Rowe's case, in case you need to be brought up to speed. So the morning of March 8th, Trevion Rowe got off the bus at James P.B. Duffy School number 12 on South Avenue, and that's when he left the school campus. We're learning that he was upset about losing a cell phone on the bus the day before, and his sister says that before he left the bus that morning, he said he would kill himself. Three teachers marked Trevion present at school that day, so school district officials didn't realize he was missing until late afternoon when his mother, Carrie Houston, called the school to ask why he wasn't on the bus. Superintendent Barbara Dean Williams told the media that at least one teacher went back the next day and tried to change those attendance records. Those three teachers have been removed from their posts, and the principal of school number 12 was dismissed on Friday. Police weren't notified until about 4:45 on March 8th that Trevion was missing. Reports say numerous 911 calls were made just after he left the school, with some of them describing a young man who could be distraught standing on the Douglas Anthony Bridge. State police responded to those calls, but they say they didn't find anything. Protocol at the 911 center dictates that in cases like this, the fire department and the Rochester Police Department scuba team should have been dispatched, but Mayor Lovely Warren says they weren't. She says the dispatchers that should have followed that protocol and didn't were suspended. A massive community search was underway in the days after Trevion's disappearance, with thousands of community members on the ground. A focus of the search was also at Mount Hope Cemetery. And police later admitted that they focused on that area because Trevion once went there with the purpose of killing himself. That's according to RPD. On Sunday, March 11th, Trevion's body was found in the Genesee River 4 days after he went missing. The next day, hundreds of people attended a vigil in his honor at the Blue Cross Arena. Now, yesterday, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and New York State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia launched a statewide investigation into the facts and circumstances surrounding his death. As part of that investigation, they will review the school district's policies, procedures, and protocols to determine what improvements need to be made to ensure the safety of students going forward. And in recent days, we've learned about some red flags in this case that we didn't know early on. The Democrat and Chronicle reported that it was clear the school district officials, among others, knew that Trevion Rowe had thoughts of harming himself. And knowing that before, that should have added to the urgency of tracking him. And it raises the question, if he had run away from school before, why wasn't an aide meeting him at the bus? He was also not classified as a student with autism. He was classified as a student with a learning disability. So that raises the question, if he had been classified more appropriately, would he have been eligible for more services? And would that have prevented his death? So this hour, we're talking about a number of failures in the system, the system breaking down, who is accountable, and what we can do moving forward to try to prevent this from ever happening again. So I'll open this to my guests now. Melanie, I know you have a lot of thoughts about what has happened in recent days and the fact that Trevion went unnoticed. And what I'd like you to do is just share what you shared with me earlier. So outside of these factors that I've described, you think there's a bigger issue at play?
Yes, I do. I believe that one of the reasons Trevion was not seen was because he was Black and male. And the fact of the matter is, when he walked away, people didn't see him. And when I mean that, we talk about this in the technical way that you use your eyes and you see, but it's not just about using our eyes and seeing. It's about, do we see this person? Do we see them as human? Do we see them as worthy of care and concern? Do we see them? Because when he walked away, people didn't see him. When the 911 calls came in, he wasn't seen by the dispatchers. You know, because my thing is what I know from my previous experience in working in things related to race is that if he had not been young and Black and male, what I truly believe based upon my study of the literature, based upon my personal lived experience, is that when he was walking across the expressway, as people have said, someone would have seen him, they would have stopped. When they saw him leave, when he was walking away from the campus, someone would have stopped him and questioned him. If when he was on the bridge, someone would have stopped to say something. If he was on the bridge looking scared and being young and white and a child, someone would have said something. Someone would have stopped. Someone would have done something. But because he was young and Black and male, it rendered him invisible. And even to go forth to the search, it wasn't until a second intersection was added to his identity, the intersection of autism, it raised him and made him visible to the broader community.
Tiandra Brown, what do you think about that? Do you agree with Melanie?
Well, I don't know. First, let me extend condolences to the family. This is a great tragedy that should not have happened. If, in fact, race had something to do with this young man's death, then that raises an even higher level of concern than I came into the studio with. The Board of Regents and the State Education Department and the Attorney General have teamed up to do an investigation to find out exactly what went wrong. Once we know what went wrong, then we can talk about any necessary changes in protocols and practices. It may well be that nothing has to change in the way of policies and practices. It may actually be a matter of enforcing those policies and practices and finding out who was in charge and who failed on that day. This is a something that should not have happened, and hopefully we can put measures in place so that it doesn't happen again.
I'd like to listen to a short clip of Superintendent Barbara Dean Williams and School Board President Van White, which was recorded at a press conference on Tuesday. And they are taking responsibility for Trevion Rowe's death. We'll listen to that, and then I'll go back to our panel. I want to ask Terry some specific questions about how autism relates to this entire case. So first, here is Van White and Barbara Dean Williams.
I had to, along with my colleague, Commissioner LeBron, look a grieving mother in the eye and tell her that we had made a mistake, a grievous mistake, an unalterable mistake. We are here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to take full and complete responsibility for this young man's passing. Others may dialogue about what they did and why certain things happened, but today, at 131 West Broad Street at 4:30, my job as president of the Board of Education is to communicate to you on behalf of my colleagues and everyone who works for the district that we are sorry.
So this is a particularly difficult moment because as a mom who had sent students to school every day, we know that we fully entrust our children to the schools and don't expect that this kind of tragic occurrence will happen. So for that, I am deeply sorry.
Barbara Dean Williams, superintendent of the Rochester City School District. I'll turn to Terry Mine of Happiness House in CP Rochester. Terry, there are a lot of issues at play here with how Trevion Rowe was classified as a student. He was classified as a student with a learning disability. But in your opinion, is the district responding appropriately to what has happened?
You know, I'm not going to speak for the district themselves. I know they're doing their own investigation, and the state is also going to do an investigation. Well, I would say on behalf of the Golisano Autism Center and the three agencies that represents is that it's our belief that each individual with autism needs individualized supports and planning, and that those supports and planning for them needs to be able to change at a moment's notice. And so, you know, there's some things we really want to talk about today during the call. The first is the personal GPS systems that are available for individuals that can help locate an individual. But in that case, in this case, we know that the field, when Trevion left the school, his mother may have gotten an alert that he had left the school, and the school could also get an alert that he had left the school. And so we'd like to a chance to talk about that later in the call. But also, the thing that happens in a circumstance like this is it begins the conversation. It begins the conversation between the school and parents and community organizations. And what we want to make sure is that that conversation continues, and that in addition to the conversation, that we have drills, that, you know, we have policies and procedures to prevent this kind of tragedy, but we need to drill and practice to prevent this type of thing again.
We will absolutely talk about all those issues, especially IEPs and how individualized plans for students should change. So that is something we will definitely talk about this hour. I'd like to turn back to Melanie. What are your thoughts on leadership from the district, specifically Superintendent Barbara Dean Williams in this case?
I am not here to talk about Barbara and her handling of this. What my thing is, where I want the focus of my time here to be, is to raise the specter of the adaptive challenge that we face, not just as a district, but as a community, around who we see.
I'd like you to clarify your comment, because an anonymous caller called in and says that Trevion Rowe wasn't overlooked. People were out looking for him, and he questions your comment that he was invisible. I'd like to say you were talking about his humanity as an individual, not the physical person, but the fact that he is a young African-American boy.
The fact that he was a young let me be incredibly clear. If all things were being equal and he was white, the chances of him being able to walk off of the School 12 campus unseen would have been less. The chances of him being able to walk along the expressway to the Freddie Sue Bridge without somebody stopping would have been less. The chances of him being able to go to the bridge, look at the bridge, be on the other side of the bridge, and no one stopping for care and concern would have been less. And whether we want to talk about it or not, whether we want to own that or not as a community, is up to us. But that does not make it any less a fact, because we know that the literature states there is a study that talks about how young black boys are seen as larger, older, and more dangerous. There are studies that talk about how young black boys, there's tons of studies about the way that we as a society view young black males. When we're not viewing them as a threat, we can view them as they can be rendered invisible. So my thing is that what I'm saying is backed up by the literature. And what I'm saying is that what I want us to not get lost in here is when people first wanted to look for him, it wasn't until we found out that he was a child with autism. it was the intersection of autism that made him visible and had hundreds of people looking. And I'm thankful for the people who looked. I'm a mother of a child on the spectrum. I am thankful that people went out and looked for this baby and brought him home. At the same time, I want us to be able to be in this place, to have the critical conversation that if we're saying we're going to know every child by face and name, and that we are one Rochester, that we do the work that is necessary for us to walk our talk.
I'd like to listen to the other cut with Superintendent Barbara Dean Williams, because as you mentioned, Melanie, the intersection of the autism diagnosis was a huge part of this case. So we'll listen to what she had to say, and then I have some questions for Terry and for Andrew about that.
Also significant is that Trevon was not classified in our system as a student with autism. As you may know, autism is primarily a medical diagnosis, and although there are indications that Trevon was indeed a student with autism, we're still reviewing why he was not so classified. Moreover, his record does not specifically identify Trevon as having a regular tendency to wander away from school. I'm pointing this out now only to indicate why a monitor was not specifically designated to escort him from his bus to the building. However, we must and we will redouble our efforts to ensure that our children with disabilities in this district are properly classified and ensure our school staff are as vigilant as possible for all children, both during bus arrival and departure times.
After hearing that, my question for the panel is how does a student become classified as a student with autism in a school? Can a school do an intervention, or does that diagnosis have to come from elsewhere? And how is an IEP created?
So a child can be diagnosed as having a disability within the school system itself, but the diagnosis of autism is a medical diagnosis and needs to come from a medical professional. An IEP is created once a school district determines an individual has a level of disability that requires additional supports above and beyond those in the general education setting. And the student's parent, if the child is older, the child themselves, and representatives from the school district and a family advocate come together to decide what those resources should be, those additional supports and services. And again, that's subject to change. But it's the fact that he had an IEP, it doesn't really matter if the diagnosis of autism was attached to that or not. His individual needs are expected to be met within that IEP itself.
And Megan, I think the bigger, more important issue is all students are entitled to a level of care that provides for their safety. When a parent puts his or her child on a school bus, you expect that child to be maintained in a safe way, on the way to school, getting off the bus, going into the schoolhouse, and then leaving the schoolhouse, getting back on the bus, and being transported back home. So the fact that this student was able to get off the bus and walk away without anybody knowing it for more than 10 hours is frankly shocking. And that is very disturbing to me as a member of the Regents and to State Education Department. That's one of the reasons why we're getting involved to do this investigation along with the Attorney General. All students are entitled to a level of care. It doesn't matter. Certain students have special needs and they may have heightened levels of needs and care. That's for the school to know. School has to provide for individual parents, or rather adults, to meet the students, to escort the students into the schoolhouse. That didn't happen here. And we're looking to find out why.
In your opinion, well, there have been calls for Superintendent Barbara Dean Williams, for School Board President Van White, and for the Rochester Teachers Association President Anna Urbanski to step down. Do you agree with those calls?
Well, I don't want to speak to that right now because we're preparing to launch an investigation. And I don't know where the failures were. Clearly, there were failures. We intend to get to the bottom of this and find out why this was allowed to happen and then make recommendations so that it never happens again. We're coming in to do not a criminal investigation. We're coming in to do a civil investigation. We hope to yield information that will enable this community to continue on in such a way that it will be stronger.
So that is a civil investigation. In terms of criminal charges, my colleague Beth Adams asked the Rochester Police Department if criminal charges are out of the question. She asked for confirmation on that, and a spokesperson for the RPD said, quote, the RPD is waiting to see if there's an independent probe by an outside agency before a decision is made to conduct an investigation into the matter. Any decision made with respect to an investigation will involve a conversation between the RPD and the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. But last Tuesday at the news conference, Rochester Police Department Chief Michael Simonelli cast doubt on the idea of criminal charges. He said, quote, at this point, I don't contemplate any criminal charges being filed. That's in response to the question. And he said, quote, you'd have to find evidence of a crime. So in his opinion, there isn't any evidence of a crime. And again, there are investigations that are ongoing. There's information we don't have right now. But the broader issue here is that someone needs to be held accountable so that changes can be made. Terry, in your opinion and that of Happiness House and the Golisano Autism Center, what is the biggest change that needs to be made in the short term? So if there are other students who have challenges that are similar to those that Trevion had, what can we do to help them now?
First, I think the biggest change is to open the communication, to find the root cause of the issues at hand for Trevion, and not just Trevion, all the students, and make sure that the community is engaged in those conversations. To have drills for emergencies. I know that the Al Siegel Community of Agencies and Autism stepped in to help with the search, but we have no experience in that. I think they did a fine job, but I think they could have done a better job if there had been drills and they had been prepared. And so to be able to have those conversations, not just within the school district, but within the entire community, and to use each other's strengths and resources to build on.
Melanie, what would you like to see in the short term?
In the short term, I would like to see us coming together and seeing what we can do to make sure that every child is seen, to make sure that every child, that we know who our children are, and that we as a community take ownership over each and every child. Every child is our own. And understanding that, you know, and getting at the biases and things that exist in our community that keep us from seeing every child, and start to address those things, so that if you see a child that is of school age walking on the street during a school day when they should be in school, that you would feel comfortable to say, hey, baby, what's going on with you? You know, or I mean, that's what I would say, you know, colloquially, you know, but just to express that care and concern. Because if I saw your child, you know, and let's say your child is 12 or 13 and I know it's a school day and I see a child just walking, I would want to come up to that child and say, baby, where are you supposed to be? And why don't we do that as a community?
Andrew, I know the investigation is ongoing and you can't speak to specifics yet, but in your opinion, as a vice chancellor for the Board of Regents, what would you like to see change in the short term?
A couple of things. One, there's a longer term investigation that is about to be launched, and we will get answers to some of the questions that we've been struggling with. In the short term, I would like to see the school and the district look at its policies and protocols to make sure that they are properly in place so that this doesn't happen again. And then what we come out with in the way of a longer investigation report, I would hope that they would embrace that and learn from that to make sure that our schools remain safe and secure for all students, to give parents the comfort of knowing that their kids have been properly entrusted to the city school district each and every day that they get on that school bus.
And in this environment that we live in with drills, not just around issues like this, but we hear about communities having drills around active shooter drills, we need to create the balance of creating safety without creating undue anxiety and trauma for our children. You know, we want children to feel safe and nurtured and affirmed in the places where they are. We want parents to know that they are entrusting their children and that we see every child and their children are safe. But we also have to do that in a way that does not evoke anxiety and trauma in children or in the adults that we are entrusting to care for our children.
And then for the students that it's appropriate, these personal GPS devices, I think we have to find the resource so the school and the parent gets an alert that says this child is not where you expect them to be. They have left the area that you defined as their normal day. Certainly that's the only thing in this conversation so far that would have given us time to react in a way that we would have been successful.
Even if the robocall had been made to Trevion's mother about him not being at school, that would have happened 75 minutes after the start of the school day. And based on what we're reading and we're learning, he had already passed away at that point. Who is eligible for these GPS tracking devices? Would he have been eligible if the way he was classified at the school were different?
And my understanding right now is that they're not part of a normal IEP and they're not a resource that's available, but that right now it's parents who can afford to purchase those things that are purchasing them, and that should never be the determinant of who gets the support that they need. And so any legislation, any way that any child who has a history of elopement or a child who's having a significant mental health issue, that we want to know that they really are with the adults we think they're with, that they would have access to this personal GPS system.
Is that something the Board of Regents can look into? Is that a policy issue that Regents may have control over?
I don't know if we would have control over, but it's certainly something that we can look into. And we will look into that and see if that would have made a difference here. I'm not familiar with this being utilized by this school or by this district, so I'm not fully familiar with it.
Yeah, one of the unique features that is new, fairly new, is this geofence. And so the information is put in that this individual, this child, or it could be a senior with a disability as well, these are the places that they go in their day, and this is when you expect them to be there. And so when they leave that geofence, they've exited that area, an alert goes to those people that you have identified that says they're not where you expect them to be. And it tells you exactly where they are, and so you can respond, versus a robocall that mom may or may not get that says, I am or am not at school.
Well, what is troubling here is, again, 10 hours went by. We're talking about the welfare of the child, but there's also the mental comfort of the parent. Those of us who have kids in schools, when we put our kids on school buses, we expect that they're going to be safe on the school bus ride and at the school. Here, there was a clear breach, and we look forward to finding out how that possibly could have happened in the first place, and then how another 9-10 hours went by before the parent was notified. That's not acceptable on any level.
It makes you think about Carrie Houston, Trevion's mother, going about her day thinking everything is fine. Mm-hmm. He's at school, he's learning, he's doing well. And then having to call the school after the bus shows up and he's not there and saying, where is my child? And you're right, 10 hours after
It caused me a level of outrage when I first heard of this story that should never have occurred. That's the frank fact. Anyone who puts their kid on a school bus has certain expectations. They were not met. And this could have happened to many kids across the district. Unfortunately, it happened to one, Trevion. And again, my condolences go out to his family. And hopefully we will find answers that not only can instruct the school district in going for it, but also give a level of comfort to the family.
There was a similar, oh, I'm sorry.
There's something that Regent Brown said I want to highlight, that my thing is that I want us to talk about how we keep all kids safe. And because my thing is, if, let's say, Trevion had not had autism, and let's say that he was a kid who was feeling, who did not have that diagnosis, but all the other things that they were feeling that he was feeling, and he would, the declarations and all those other things were the same, what would have happened? You know, our thing is, how do we see every child and keep them all safe and meet that expectation that you talked about, that when a parent puts a kid on a bus, that the kid is at where they are and that they can trust in that, and that we know what we need to know that we can keep all of our kids safe.
There was a similar case in 2013 in New York City that involved a 14-year-old boy with autism named Avante Okendo. He wandered away from his public school in Queens and was found dead 3 months later in the East River. So it took school officials in Queens about 45 minutes to figure out that he was gone and notify his mother and the police, and the search began immediately after that. So 45 minutes after they realized he was missing, the search began. That case resulted in some education policies for schools, or policies for schools about safety in their buildings. And I'm going to read some guidelines here, and I'd like to ask Regent Brown about if they should be changed based on the current news that we're talking about. So one of them, staff training on awareness and response, supervisory notification and 911 calls, communication protocols with local police, use of school-wide communication and alert systems, pre-assignments for building and ground searches, procedures for assuring that crisis response and law enforcement officials have access to floor plans, blueprints, schematics, and other maps of the school interior, school grounds, and roadmaps of the immediate surrounding area, immediate family notification, identification of students with known elopement behaviors to local building principals, consideration of installment of door alarms, and ensuring students with known elopement behaviors carry basic identification information at all times. Does this cover enough? Should these be broadened? Should they be more specific?
I don't know. From what you just read, that is a very strong list of protocols. Those protocols and policies certainly weren't followed here. If they were, perhaps we wouldn't be sitting here talking about this today. So we have to keep in mind that whatever we come up with, however great those policies and protocols are, ultimately they're only as good as the people who stand behind them. And that's why I said earlier, it may not be that we need a change in policies and protocol. It may be that we have to do more to enforce the following and application of those policies and protocols. And had School 12 done what it should have done, perhaps we wouldn't be sitting here. Because if the school had done what it should have done, Trevium would not have been allowed to walk away. He would have been properly ushered into the school building. The fact that he wasn't gives me great cause for concern. And then on top of that, the fact that supposedly three teachers marked him present, which we haven't even talked about, that by itself raises concern. Further, the fact that he was missing for 10 hours before the parents were notified, and they weren't notified until he failed to come back home on the school bus, that's just another level of failure. So it certainly seems like there's a combination of failures here, and we have to do whatever we have to do, whatever is necessary, to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And it may be that we have to take steps to be absolutely certain that the parents in charge at these schools are following the policies and protocols in place, which clearly they were not doing here.
I'm seeing the phone starting to ring. Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions or observations. 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, or you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So we'll go to the phones, and first up is Tom in Greece. Go ahead, Tom.
Hello, thank you. This was briefly mentioned by one of your guests. Okay, I'm just wondering about, I know those three teachers who marked him as present were put on leave, but have they explained their actions, why they did that? And I'm just wondering why, that's all.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Or how they could have done it, or, okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your question. I'll open that up to the panel. I know we don't have very much information at this point, but he's correct. Three teachers marked Trevion as absent. One teacher, we're hearing reports that teacher went back to try to change the record. What else do we know? What am I missing?
I don't know, and I know they're doing their own investigation, but in order to take attendance, you have to know the children, especially at that age. So, you know, I don't want to admit to any prior bad acts, but I may have said here for more than myself in high school when there was a substitute teacher, middle school, a substitute teacher. And so you actually need someone that knows the students to take attendance. And and especially in a class like gym or art where the students are in motion, they're not sitting at a desk where you can look and say, wait, I'm supposed to have 20 children. I have 18. Who's not here? You have 18 kids moving in front of you. It's a So to me, that's the question. And there's been some reports that it was a substitute teacher, some reports that it wasn't. I don't know from the outside, but the person taking attendance needs to know the student's face. They need to know who's in front of them.
Melanie, I see you nodding.
It goes to what I've been saying since I sat down. You need to be able to see them, and you need to see their humanity and know your children. You know, I mean, I can't speak to the exact happenings of those teachers at that time, but if I know that Mary always wears a pink hat, you know, and Billy always, you never catch him without his headphones over his head. You know your kids. And it just again says that he wasn't seen.
I have a question that's more about logistics, maybe. His special education teacher did mark him as absent. Where's the breakdown in the school? Because his mother thought he was at school. She did not call and say, Trevion's not coming to school today. So what happens between a teacher marking a kid absent? Does that go to an office and then they compare, you know, we haven't gotten a call from his mother. Where is he? Does that happen? And if it doesn't, how do we get that to happen?
I'm not sure for the city school district how it happens. In other districts, if parents don't call, then the school district is calling the parent individually. I've heard robocalls are used by the city school district. I don't know. I know also in other districts, if there's a difference in attendance between one period and the next, that they'd be looking into what happened. Did the student leave during the day? Different things. But I'm have no information on the city school district.
And attendance is taken at the beginning of the day. So you don't, there is fault, seemingly, on the part of the three teachers that marked him present, because that should not happen. I don't care if you are the regular teacher in that classroom or if you're a substitute. I don't care if it's your first day in that classroom or in that school building. If you're told that you have a list of 20 kids and there are six of them not there, you know that someone's absent. So either to mark that someone is present gives me cause to worry that the teacher is not caring at all about who's in the classroom. So it really doesn't matter if you are the regular teacher or a substitute. You should be able to simply go down a list, determine who's not there. And at the outset of a school day, that's when you determine who is there and who is not there. You don't have to wait until multiple periods into the school day to make that determination. That should be known at the outset.
I do think that for older students, they take attendance throughout the day for each class versus an elementary student who arrives at a classroom and stays with that teacher for the day. I think the older the students get, the more they move, the more often attendance is taken.
And as a city school district parent, I know that if my child was to miss first period, miss attendance in first period, I would get a call. Now, what I know as a parent is that potentially, if my child went to first period but cut second period, right, I may not get that call to the end of the day that says, you know, because after the first period, said your child missed period one on, you know, your child state their name, missed period one on, state the date, you know, and I may not get that call till later. So it depends on how, what was done and what system was used, because while this child was an eighth grader, they were in an elementary school building.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a thing, but I know as a parent that we do, and I am a parent of the city school district, that we do get robocalls, and that, you know, there's a robocall that comes in the morning and there's a robocall that comes in the evening.
Mm. Listeners, a lot of you waiting on the phone, hang in there for us. We're going to try to hear from as many of you as possible, so I'll just ask you to try to keep it brief when we take your call. Up next on the phone is Stacy in Rochester. Go ahead.
Hi,
go ahead.
Oh. Yeah, so I feel like we're not talking about the elephant in the room, and that this child had already tried to kill himself, and that he was, you know, really not well, and that his family wasn't willing to give him the medical care that he needed. And I feel like the school is really being maligned, and rightly so. I mean, there were things that could be improved, but really, I feel like Trevion really, you know, was pretty determined, and in 30 minutes, he did it. So, you know, I think that this is a case where it's really, you know, I feel like there's a weight on the family as well, and we're not talking about that.
OK, Okay, thanks for your call, Stacey. I'll turn that over to Melanie Funches.
What we're not going to do today is blame a mama for her dead baby. Let me just be incredibly clear. That's what we're not going to do today. And what I also will say is if this mother put her child on a bus to go to school, and that child was supposed to go to school, and that child for, you know, so many years, every day had gotten off that bus and gone into the school building, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. If that mom felt that she could put that child on the bus and that child had walked in for the last 568 days and walked in every day, one would think on the 569th day that he would walk in. We're not, this mother has not laid her baby to rest yet. We will not blame the mother here today. What I would also like to say is that we hear what people are saying in the media and people are talking. We don't know what the mom was told. We don't know how this information was presented to her. We don't know if she was offered, you know, someone could just say something. And as a mental health professional, in my role as a director of community engagement at the Mental Health Association, I know many times parents are given information that is in no way helpful to them, or a way that they can use, or a way that they can understand. And because we don't know any of that, we cannot make any suppositions and pass any blame onto a parent.
I just want to add, if the doors of communication are open, it benefits everybody. If parents feel comfortable contacting the school and the school feels comfortable contacting the parents, that's in everybody's best interest. Mm-hmm.
What should we be doing in terms of mental health support in schools? Not necessarily particular to this case, but as a whole, to help students who have special needs and maybe are struggling with some mental health challenges. What kind of changes can we look at? And again, I'll say in the short term, Melanie.
What we need to do is we need to reduce the stigma around mental health. We need to become comfortable as adults in the lives of children, talking about mental health and mental wellness with our children, with their parents, and with one another. We need to stop saying that certain things don't happen in certain communities. We need to stop saying that certain groups of people don't kill themselves, or that we need to stop saying that mental health is a moral failing, or that, you know, anxiety and all these things, that there's something wrong with you. We need to become incredibly comfortable, especially in light of a lot of the things that we know our children experience in the ways of living life, that we need to become incredibly comfortable about talking about mental health and mental wellness, so that it becomes just as easy as when we tell children to brush their teeth and to a happy birthday twice. We need to talk about what do we do to stay mentally well, just like we tell kids about tying their shoes, we tell them about, you know, taking care of their bodies and all the other things we teach kids. We need to teach kids that their mental wellness is sacred, and that we need to show them how to take care of it, and how we as the adults and lives of children can help them do that.
Mm-hmm. Regent Brown, any thoughts on that?
I would join Melanie in her comments that we need to do more to better understand mental health and mental health concerns as they play out in schools. Certainly, we have to provide the supports to schools, whether they be financial or otherwise, so that schools can properly receive these students day in, day out, and provide that for them throughout the day. As far as beyond that, it really depends on knowing the students in the schools. There are many students with special needs, and there's a broad spectrum of those students, and they all require special care and concern. It's up to the schools to recognize who the students are in their classrooms and provide whatever supports are necessary so that those students can enjoy the full plate of educational opportunities as every other student in the school.
Up next on the phones is Barbara in Brighton. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi there. Let me just start out by saying Melanie is totally correct. It's a huge issue across the land. It's not just Rochester, or even that we are not seeing all of our children as all of our children. And that has to do with many, many things: housing segregation, school segregation, history of slavery. We could go on for months. The point is, every one of us is responsible for this child's death, even though we didn't intend that. And more involved with the schools need to have more resources in the mental health realm, namely more counselors and more social workers. Parents need to be encouraged and made to feel much more comfortable so that when Trevion is feeling bad about his phone missing and he has a history of suicidal ideation, they can feel comfortable leaving a message or calling until they get an answer saying, meet my kid at the door today. He's feeling particularly bad. Counselors and social workers need to have that connection with the kids, because otherwise, as is demonstrated, people are going to either lie and put down that he's been there today, or they're going to not see the children and not know who's who and not know whether they're there or not and what the individual concerns are. And the special ed teacher I noted is the one who noticed he wasn't there. Now, that's partly because they have smaller classes, but it's also because they're trained to know the kids as individuals. And everyone needs to take more responsibility for that. And that horrifying comment on Melanie's part about seeing a white child crossing the bridge, it's going to make me so upset, because it's so true. I really believe that people would have called had it not been a black boy. And we all need to pay more attention to those issues. Otherwise, nothing will change.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling. Related to that, I want to share a comment from someone who was supposed to be on this program today but had to cancel because her son is homesick from school today. So our thoughts go out to Brady. But this is from Carrie Putnam. She's a community columnist for the Democrat and Chronicle. And her 11-year-old son, Brady, has a rare genetic neurological disorder that causes some symptoms that were similar to what Trevion was struggling with. He has some developmental and speech delays and significant anxiety. He has an IEP with special education services and a 2-to-1 aide at school. And she wrote this on Facebook right after the news of Trevion's death. She said, quote, "My heart is just so heavy for Trevion's family. Our Brady does not have autism, but his disorder shares some common traits. He has run off before when upset. I'll never forget one time we couldn't find him for a few minutes, and her husband ran to the pond in our woods. Worst fear. His wonderful aide meets him at the door to his school every morning. One day when he was sick and I forgot to tell the attendance office that he'd be absent, I got a personal phone call within 10 minutes of the school day starting, asking where he was. Was he okay? My heart is sick that these safeguards were not allegedly in place for Trevion. Also tonight, my heart is with the men and women of RPD and others and all the families behind the badges." So thanks to Corey for that. But that's the kind of personal connection that Melanie and Terry and Regent Brown are talking about. And Ann Costello of the Golisano Foundation sent us an email earlier today, and she said that there's a need to better coordinate community resources and services and help for families to help navigate the complex systems of school and otherwise, to try to support them no matter what kind of diagnosis they have. And that's one of the reasons behind the Golisano Autism Center. And correct. I'm sure Terry can speak more to that. But there's a need for everyone to communicate better and to coordinate services. So thanks to Anne for that. We're down to our last few minutes. I'm going to try to summarize some of the calls that have come in regarding attendance. Mike in Rochester wants to know, does the attendance relate to state funding for special needs students? I'm not quite sure what he means there, but everyone around the table is shaking their heads. There seems to be no connection to that. Bill in Rochester and Robert in Fairport, with a similar question on attendance, does the system default to present? Is there some kind of, no. Melanie says, no, it does not. Teachers have to mark whether a student is present or absent. Gary and Henrietta sharing, forget SCUBA and the robocalls. What about the school staff who are supposed to meet the kids? That's the real issue. That relates to what everyone has said on this panel so far, that personal connection. And then one final quick email. This is from Isabel, who is the president of the board of directors at the M.K. Gandhi Institute of Nonviolence. She would like for the district to consider a restorative approach as we respond to Trevion's death. This would be in alignment with the adoption of restorative practices as part of the RCSD Code of Conduct and would show commitment and trust in shifting to a more humane way of addressing harm. Anyone have thoughts on restorative practices in this particular case?
There is a healing that needs to happen in our school community. And restorative practices and creating restorative circles is a tool that we already have in our toolkit that can work to bring the healing. So once the investigations have concluded and once we're doing all things, there's still a school, because everyone wants to say, who's to blame, who's to hurt? But there's a school community here who's in pain. There are children in pain. There are teachers in pain. There are administrators in pain. There's families in pain. There's a community in pain over loss. So both of these things can be true at the same time. Yes, we need to hold people accountable and do these things, and we need to create a space for healing for folks so that we can move forward together. So yes, I believe that we can use a restorative practice. I also want to highlight that one does not preclude the other. Because we're being restorative does not mean we don't hold people accountable.
That is such an important point. And to that point, the wake for Trevion Roe will be this Thursday from 7 to 9 at Bethel Christian Fellowship on East Avenue. It is open to the public. Hundreds of people in our community expressing their condolences, along with all of us on this panel and those of us at WXXI. I'd like to thank all of my guests for joining me today, T. Andrew Brown from the Board of Regents, Melanie Funches from the Mental Health Association of Rochester and the Rochester City School Board, and Terry Mine from Happiness House and CP Rochester. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
all, listeners, for sharing your thoughts. Stay with us. More Connections is next.